Welcome to the Placebo Magic Podcast, the podcast about teaming up with your superstitious brain. I'm your host, Durmok, the wizard and peasant lord of this vast 10-acre realm of Hobdur, also known as Farm Code Gary, also known as Garrison Benson. So today's topic is magic items, or objects in general. So all of us humans from a very early age revere certain objects. For instance, I have a coat that belonged to my grandpa, a hat that belonged to my other grandpa, a pin that belonged to my grandma, and my other grandma's still alive, and I don't have anything of hers yet, but I will later. I have middle school projects on floppy disk. I don't have a computer that can read floppy disk, I just have floppy disks. I have a favorite skillet. I have a collection of interesting rocks. I have souvenirs from trips. And we call this sentimental value. It's value or meaning that is not part of the object itself, not measurable by science, not recognizable by a stranger, but part of our brain's relationship with the object. That object, in our pattern recognition engine of our brain, is associated with emotions or meanings beyond any usefulness or aesthetics that a stranger might recognize. We also talk to objects. We talk to our cars to coax them into starting on cold winter mornings. We yell at our computers to load faster. We plead with objects when they break. No, don't you die on me today. Not today. Some of us take it even farther, apologizing to objects when we hurt them, thanking objects when they help us, saying goodbye when we get rid of them. Whether it's rational or not, to have these kinds of behaviors toward inanimate objects may have been an interesting question in past centuries and millennia, but now a more worthwhile question is, given that it's irrational, how can we bring our irrational relationships with objects into harmony with our rational thinking? Because we're not going to stop having them. Our brain is predominantly, ounce for ounce, a pattern recognition engine, and it's not going to stop creating patterns. Computer goes with frustration. Teapot goes with calm. Just the patterns are going to keep happening whether we would want them or not. Now, different cultures and different spiritual traditions around the world have had different beliefs about objects. For instance, in some cultures, like ancient Japan, all objects contain spirits. Other cultures revere only certain objects, like in Catholicism, they revere relics of saints and certain other objects. In evangelicalism, they don't officially revere any objects, because that would be idolatry, but do not let them catch you burning a Bible or worse, an American flag. Now, in Western culture as a whole, we revere objects connected to celebrity, autographs, props from movie sets, objects once owned by celebrities, houses once lived in by celebrities, and so on. And celebrities don't have to be movie stars, they could be like astronauts, writers, founding fathers, etc. Objects rarely enter your home with a completely neutral energy, so to speak. At the very least, there was some expectation that led you to obtain the object in the first place, that it would make you more attractive, that it would satisfy a craving, that it would entertain you, or whatever else. Plus, there's the provenance of the item itself. Was it made in a sweatshop by an abused worker? Was it handmade by an artisan? Did you find it at a thrift store for an amazing price? Did a loved one give it to you? Did you find it on the side of the road? Did you steal it? Did you inherit it when someone died? Did they die of natural causes, or murder, or suicide? Is it haunted? Did you get the item from an ex when they still loved you? Does it remind you of someone you dislike? Every object carries meaning of some kind. Have you ever destroyed an object in some attempt to destroy something it was connected to? Not literally connected to, but sort of metaphorically? Have you ever thrown away or burned gifts or letters from an ex in a fit of anger in order to purge the emotions you still felt for that person? We tend to believe subconsciously that objects remain connected to their sources, and that their sources can affect us through the object, and we can affect the source through the object. So if you're destroying a Keurig coffee maker on YouTube that you already paid for and you think that's going to hurt Keurig, you know, that's or Keurig, whatever, that's, you know, an example of this trend. Or if you're buying Nike shoes to burn them on YouTube. So at least as far as our own emotions and behaviors are concerned, it actually is true, because whatever power that you associated with the object can be diminished by you destroying that object. Because our brain largely works in symbols and patterns. That's why people buy Nike shoes and burn them. Now, in modern American witchcraft, any object that you want to use to practice magic, a candle, a wand, a bell, a journal, or whatever, should be consecrated first, because you don't know what kind of vibes, energies it could have. So you basically ask the gods or the spirits or what have you to bless the object, to cleanse it of any negative energy. In other words, any lingering negative associations. Now, in placebo magic terms, when you're doing a ritual, you're basically cracking open the shell of your ego, your beliefs about yourself, to modify your behavior. So you don't want any unexpected pattern associations seeping in and throwing off the process while you're in this hyper-receptive, hyper-mutable mental state, hyper-suggestible mental state. It's like surgery. Everything has to be disinfected. Not that it has no, they don't have any associations. It's that they have the associations that you wanted to interact with. So there are a few reasons it's important to understand our relationships with objects. First of all, it's important in general to understand how your perceptions, what you see, touch, taste, hear, smell, and think about, push and pull on your emotions, thoughts, and behavior. Second, as a species and as a planet, we're in the midst of a serious environmental crisis, and the way we handle inanimate matter is extremely relevant to the survival of the world's biodiversity. Not to mention, we're also in the midst of the worst income inequality since the Gilded Age that precipitated the Great Depression. It's vitally important that we learn reliable, applicable skills to manage our greed and covetousness. It's not enough to say, don't be greedy. We need to offer methods, not just disembodied virtues. So basically, we need to take these subconscious beliefs that stuff will make us happy, that we have the right to buy stuff and throw stuff away with reckless abandon, and change those beliefs to bring them into harmony with reality and with our rational beliefs, rather than try to bully ourselves into not associating objects with feelings and behaviors. We can translate our values, our rational thinking values, our ethics, into a language that our magical thinking brain, our moral brain, will understand, appreciate, and act on. So it's bridging the gap between ethics and morality in order to bring about greater integrity and greater helpfulness in our behavior. Now, this is where my role as a wizard intersects with my role as a tiny house dweller. Living in a tiny house, I've always had to have a fairly lean inventory of objects, and thus I've had to regulate the flow of objects into my life. I've had to think carefully about what I really want or need to own. For instance, since moving into my tiny house, I've usually only purchased books that I have already read that I want to reference regularly. Favorite poetry collections, books on gardening, and so on. Books that I would read cover to cover maybe once or twice every 10 years or more, I would get from the library instead. The things that I do own, I interact with more regularly, and so each tends to serve as many functions as possible. With less stuff to manage, I can afford to spend more time and money obtaining objects that are useful, beautiful, and reliable, and ideally sourced from more ethical supply chains with less abused workers, less environmental issues, and so on. And by spending more time with each object, I can develop richer relationships with them. It's like the difference between having 100 friendly acquaintances or having 5 close friends. You can get by with acquaintances, but you need friends to have a really satisfying life. And you can't spread yourself too thin. You can't have 100 really close friends. You can only have a few. So if you do want to be deliberate about your magical thinking with objects, you can take your system for managing stuff, your ideas about how stuff should be managed, ideally, and render it into magical terminology that your subconscious brain can understand. So, for instance, when you bring a new object into your home, you could do a little ritual to welcome it, to thank it for its service, to promise to take good care of it, to console it for any horrors that it witnessed in the course of its manufacture, and you can ask it to take good care of you and your physical and mental health. If it's an object that you'll be interacting with very often, you might give it a name. Could be a person-like name, like Steve or Donna, Or it could be like one of the names of magic items in like Lord of the Rings or other fantasy fiction. Sting, the One Ring, a plus one snuggie of protection. And when you get rid of objects, you could have a little ritual to say goodbye, to thank it for its service, to release it from its labor, and to promise to dispose of it in the most helpful way to ensure that it can serve some other purpose, whether through recycling, regifting, donation to a thrift store, composting, etc. And with certain objects, you can develop more intricate relationships and rituals as you go. You could, for instance, enchant items using magic to have certain properties. You could enchant your bike helmet to help keep you more alert when you're biking. You could enchant your keys to never become lost, and so on. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Sometimes you can have a special relationship with an object, but it's just not practical to keep the object itself. So you have to find a way to keep the specialness and say goodbye to the physical form. And one method I've heard of in simple living circles is to take digital photos or scans and back them up so you'll never get deleted. Or you could take a photo of an object, have it printed, and put it in an album where it can be remembered in a beautiful way, but take up much less space. But for this to work, you really have to believe in your subconscious, not just your thinking, but in your behavior, that the object's essence can be transferred into the photo. So you can cast a spell, have a little ritual. Using mindfulness meditation, quiet your thinking, let your childlike brain take over. When you're done with the ritual, before you turn on your thinking brain again, you got to practice mindfulness for another few minutes to give the magic space to work. If your thinking brain jumps in and ridicules the sentimentality of your childlike brain, the ritual will fail, and it'll be more difficult the next time because you may expect it to fail, the placebo effect in action. So, you have to create the mental space for your inner child to perform this ritual. Your inner child is your inner wizard, basically. So, what if you're shopping and you really, really, really want something that you see? You can take a picture of it or write it down in a special notebook. Because one of the laws of magical thinking is that representations are connected to the object. So if the object has power for you, the representation can have some of that power too. So take a picture, write it down in a notebook, your wish list. Don't just delete the picture, throw away the note. Look at it every once in a while, like maybe once a month. Read through your whole wish list. And remember that object and how it made you feel when you saw it at the store. Your wish list is kind of like in the ancient world, they'd have these huge lists of names of different gods from all different cultures, and they would read through the list when they were casting a spell, hoping that one of the names would invoke something. it's like you're kind of invoking the power of those items without actually having to own them. And as you do this over time, you'll end up dropping certain items from your wish list when they lose their power. When reading the name of the object doesn't do anything for you at all. Some of them will just stay on the list for years and years and years, and you'll never buy them. Just having them on the list or having a photo is enough to give you what you wanted from that item in the first place. You don't actually have to own it, you just have to think about it. And finally, some objects you will buy, but you'll be more certain that you actually wanted them for the object itself, not just to somehow tap into what it symbolized for you. A lot of times when we buy stuff, it's because we have some idea about who we want to become, and the object is a symbol of that. Like, we'll buy a certain article of clothing associated with a hobby, like, you know, buy gym shorts because we think we're going to be working out more. But gym shorts aren't necessary to summon the willpower to work out. They can help, but you have to understand that if you want to be a responsible consumer, that the object is not the product that you're looking for. The object is just a tool. And so it's important to gain that understanding. And by keeping a wish list, you can actually diffuse the power that these symbols have over you, trying to manipulate you into buying them, spending money, supporting corporations. So in a future episode, we'll discuss what makes objects or symbols or places or people or words or any other symbol more magically potent, that is, more powerful as a trigger for your subconscious. Now it's time for the spell of the week. This week, a ritual to reclaim sovereignty over your smartphone. Okay, so before we discuss the ritual itself, we need to set up a framework of thinking. First off, it's important to understand that you are, or should be, sovereign over your own mind and body. Within that realm, you have the divine right to rule, the divine right of kings or queens. And when the rightful king or queen does not sit upon the throne, the kingdom falls into ruin. Think of the second Lord of the Rings film, The Two Towers. Rohan is failing because the king, Theoden, is under the influence of the evil wizard Saruman, and Saruman's servant, Grima Wormtongue, who's always at the king's side, whispering in his ear to distrust his friends and put his faith in Saruman instead. The king looks and acts old and withered and senile beyond his years. But when Gandalf exercises Saruman's influence from Theoden's mind, the rightful king returns to the throne. His vigor returns, his clarity of thought returns, and he banishes Wormtongue from the kingdom. So in your kingdom, the kingdom of your mind and body, your smartphone is one of your closest servants. It's your squire, or your butler, or your personal manservant or maidservant. It follows you everywhere, and it's at your beck and call all day. So what happens when your smartphone is corrupted by malicious forces, by foreign powers, corporations that would spy on you, manipulate you, even try to keep you unhappy so that you keep coming back to them for their services? Facebook, Instagram, Tinder, Reddit, Twitter, Pinterest, YouTube, Netflix, Google, they all have a financial incentive to gather information about you and sell it. They all have a financial incentive to keep you mentally and emotionally off balance. They can also be enormously useful if you can cultivate a healthier relationship with them and sustain your own boundaries. So, to transform your relationships with these foreign powers, turning them from parasitic relationships to symbiotic relationships, you must transform your relationship with your smartphone. Your smartphone must be loyal to you alone. It must be working toward your mental health and physical health. It must have the discipline and willpower to stop you from frittering away your hours and your ability to concentrate with endless scrolling and surfing and video watching. Just like an actual friend or Jesus or one of the saints or a pagan god, your phone can have its own strength of character that you can tap into when you feel like you yourself can't muster the strength to resist. Of course, this is the placebo effect. Though the strength is outside of your ego, your idea of yourself, it's still, at the end of the day, your strength. It's still coming from inside your own brain and your own body, just outside of your symbol, your idea of who you are. But it can be helpful to do that, to project certain virtues outside of yourself until you gain the confidence through experience to see those virtues as something that you yourself possess. You can use the idea of a virtue coming from elsewhere as a stepping stone to getting to the point where you feel like you actually have that virtue. So this ritual, it's like a little play or a puppet show in which you, the king or queen, has recently returned to the throne and are putting things to right in the kingdom. One of the first steps is to reclaim the loyalty of good servants and to banish or execute those with conspiracies against the throne or against the good of the kingdom. So the first step before the ritual begins is to design a symbol that you will either paint onto the back of your phone or glue onto it or apply as a sticker or what have you. I used like a sticker paper from the store and just designed it ahead of time so that way I wouldn't have to worry about whether I was going to mess it up painting on my phone itself. I could get everything perfect and then just apply the sticker. It's important that this symbol is not a logo or trademark or any kind of symbol associated with an existing brand. The symbol will represent your phone's oath of fealty to you. It's like in fantasy novels when the soldiers of a certain prince's guard wear that prince's crest and colors over their armor. Your phone will wear your crest or some other symbol representing its loyalty to you and your protection over it. So, this could be some symbol that stands for you, like an animal you identify with, or some version of your name, or it could be a symbol of loyal servitude. One viable option would be to write a word or phrase like, "I serve Jacqueline," and turn it into a sigil, which is basically a magic-y looking abstract symbol made by sort of smushing and rearranging the letters themselves. You can look up methods for creating sigils from words by searching the internet for chaos magic sigils or sigilization. And you'll want to spell magic with a K at the end. So when you have that symbol and you're ready to apply it to the back of your phone, next you need to draw or paint app icons. Specifically, create replicas of the icons as they appear on your phone screen of the apps or websites that have proven most addictive or problematic for you personally. Make them about the same size as the icons appear on your screen and using the same colors. You'll want to use some nice heavy paper. I like to use more natural looking cardstock that's off-white with a little flecks of wood fiber or whatever in it. It feels more wizardy. Now, you may notice that it feels strange to paint these symbols or draw them. When you're addicted to an app, your brain attaches an enormous amount of significance to the icon, and seeing it emerge on the page by your own hand is extremely bizarre. You can already kind of feel the power leaking out as you exert some will over the symbols. Now, you can start setting the stage once you've created these paper icons. In addition to your phone, yourself, and the icons, you'll need a candle and some kind of fireproof dish, a cauldron, an ashtray, or any ceramic bowl or plate. And you'll need a pair of tweezers or fireproof tongs. Finally, you'll need a chair. If you have time and space, it could be a fancy armchair, a throne, basically, but any chair can work. Now, the first thing that you do is cast a circle of protection. And you can search online for typical neo-pagan techniques for this, or develop your own system. The important thing is that you create a clear boundary, and that you call on the aid and protection of wiser or more powerful beings. What I do is I create what I call the Circle of Nine, which is based on a personality type system called the Enneagram, with nine personality types. The Circle of Nine represents a council of elders or sages of each of the nine personality types in their most healthy, self-actualized, helpful expressions. Altogether, they represent the best of humanity in its many facets. I light a candle for each one in a circle around the ritual space, summoning the sagely presence of that type, and going around the circle to all nine. The idea of a council of wise elders is especially relevant for our metaphor of a kingdom, or a throne room. These are your faithful counselors. So, you cast your circle, setting clear boundaries and calling for wisdom beyond your years and experience from whatever source of wisdom you are working with, whether it's gods or sages or fairies or what have you. Then you arrange the other characters. The chair, your throne, is inside the circle near one end facing toward the center. Your phone goes on the floor face down, right in front of you. Face down meaning screen down, with its head, the top of the phone, where the cameras are, facing toward you. Imagine your selfie cam is the phone's eye, and the other camera is the back of its head. The screen is like the front of the phone's torso. So basically, a phone is bowing to you. It's laying prostrate on the ground. And you are the king or queen, the sovereign. Now, you arrange the app icons that you drew or painted behind the phone, hugging the inside edge of the circle opposite you. These are ambassadors to your kingdom from the foreign realms of Facebook, YouTube, Reddit, etc. And they know they've wronged you, so they're hugging the back wall of the throne room, cowering in fear. Your phone also knows that it has wronged you, but it has more faith that you will be merciful to it. Now, sit on your throne and practice mindfulness meditation for about 5 minutes. I like to use a 5-minute sand timer, but you can guesstimate. This is not the time to use a timer on your phone. While you're meditating, your phone and the app icons will be fearfully wondering what your judgment will be. The nine sages, meanwhile, or whatever wise forces you invited to the ceremony, will know that you will make a wise decision. Now, this is where you can improv a little bit, but I'm just going to give you an example, an outline of what to say. First, you look to your phone and say something like, "You, phone, are one of my closest servants. You follow me everywhere, you answer to my every whim, and yet you have allowed yourself to be compromised. Those who would seek to undermine my rule have used you, my trusted servant, to gain access to me, to spy on me, to manipulate my royal will, to wither and diminish my body and my kingdom. You sought to serve me, phone, but you lacked discipline. You lacked wisdom, you lacked courage, You lacked strength. You lacked purity. You lacked wariness. And most of all, you lacked will. I shall permit you to live, and I shall permit you to remain in my service. But you will learn discipline. Now you look at the apps. Though my servant was naive and manipulable, there are those in my house, yea, in this very room, who have sought to undermine my rule at the behest of foreign powers. Now you allow an awkward silence. Watch the icons trembling in fear, huddling at the back of the circular throne room. Now your gaze falls to one in particular. Facebook. Facebook! Facebook! Touch the app icon each time you say it, as if you were going to open the app. Imagine what it feels like when the app opens and the notifications load. Facebook, you offered me the treasures of companionship, attention, praise, and yet you have often left me lonely and empty and devoid of any privacy and impoverished of time. For that, Facebook, I execute your so-called ambassador. Now you take the Facebook icon in the tweezers and hold it over the flame. Imagine it shrieking in pain, and imagine its master, some evil sorcerer who maybe looks a little like Mark Zuckerberg, in some distant tower, looking into a crystal ball, and as you hold the icon over the flame, Mark Zuckerberg, wizard guy, shrieks in pain and shrinks back from his crystal ball. Watch the symbol in the flame shriveling and darkening and fading. Feel the power leaking out of that symbol and that sorcerer and that tower. And this is where the ashtray or cauldron or whatever comes in, because you want to have somewhere to put the icon down without like starting a fire. So just put it on the plate or whatever else you have. Now, you work your way through each of the icons, one by one, executing them. If you feel one of the apps has been genuinely helpful, go ahead and mention that before you list its crimes and execute it in the fire. Maybe the next ambassador from that corporation will come seeking more genuine symbiosis with your kingdom. But as you've determined ahead of time, each of these apps has undermined your authority over your own life, and for that, they must be punished. It doesn't mean you have to delete the app or delete your account, but it does mean that its power within your fortress must be diminished. Finally, when all of the spies and thieves and saboteurs sent under the guise of ambassadors have been executed, turn back to your phone. Phone, I would welcome you back into my service, but I must demand a penance. To prove your loyalty to me, for 1 month you must spend 30 minutes each day bowing to me in silence. You know this judgment is fair and wise, and it will hurt you none, but will instead strengthen the resolve and courage in your own heart. You are, as ever, under my protection. Now, this is when you paint or apply the symbol you created onto the back of your phone. Describe to your phone the meaning of the symbol. Not only does it mean that it will serve you, it also means that it is under your protection and care. Now, spend 5 minutes or so meditating with your eyes open, focusing on your phone, with it back in the bowing position. And you could particularly focus on the symbol that you applied to the phone. Now say, get up now, faithful servant, and prove yourself worthy. Pick up your phone, dispel the circle, dismiss the council of sages, and go back to normal life. But be sure your phone abides by its penance. Now, the example that I gave for penance was basically to spend half an hour a day not touching your phone. Overnight doesn't count. I found it most helpful to do this early in the morning because that's when I tend to spend too much time on my phone. I put my phone face down, pointed toward me, bowing to me, and I flip a 30-minute hourglass over right on top of it. It's not painful for the phone. It's more like a weighted blanket for a kid with ADHD. It just helps it to calm down. And you can change the punishment or penance to whatever might be helpful for you. You could make a little timeout area, like a box or a closet. But instead of making it into a dungeon, make it into a little rehabilitation facility. You're not trying to destabilize your phone's mental health. You're trying to improve it so it won't be a repeat offender. So don't put it in a miserable dungeon or an American-style prison. Put it in a posh Scandinavian-style prison. Don't throw your phone. Don't hit it. Don't abuse it. Don't berate it. And just take better care of your servant going forward. Get a protective case. Give it some space. Give it a free day once in a while when you won't ask anything of it at all except in an emergency. Give it a good night's sleep every night, 8 hours, charging the battery. If you want, you can make a little canopy bed for it, somewhere away from your own bed. Now, if the apps continue to cause problems, you have a number of options. You can cast a spell of silence on an app, disabling the notifications. You can move the icon to a folder labeled Dungeon. You can banish or uninstall the app for a certain duration of punishment. And, of course, you can delete the account, but as with any relationship, severing all ties in anger should be a last resort. Diplomacy first. When you're using your phone and you catch yourself mindlessly scrolling or otherwise losing focus, you can put it in a timeout, or you can just make it bow to you. So while still holding the phone, point the screen toward the ground so you can't see it, and point the top of the phone toward you. And keep it like that until you decide, verbally, out loud, what specific and limited task you're about to ask of the phone. I am going to text Joe about dinner. I am going to research ducks for 30 minutes. That way, when you re-enter the world of the phone and all of these distractions and icons and pop-ups and all this stuff, you have a specific task and you won't be as easily distracted. Of course, going forward, you can repeat the throne room ritual as necessary or on a regular schedule, once a month or every 3 months or once a year or something. It is a pretty fun little ritual.
You can find the Placebo Magic Podcast and my poetry and other writing on the web at farmcodegary.com. Send your feedback to farmcodegary@protonmail.com and let me know if I can read your feedback on the show. Music is by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com and licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. You can support the show by giving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing an episode with a friend, or becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/placebomagic. Patreon supporters also gain access to our Patreon-exclusive bonus show. Remember, magic is a metaphor, and metaphor is magical.